So the way that I wanted to run this, okay, it's asking me for recording. Okay, yes, consenting to recording. So the way that I wanted to run this is I do have, originally I'd said that I wouldn't have slides, and turns out that I do, but there's not much to see on those slides. So the way that I'd want to do this is perhaps take a few minutes at the beginning to quickly go through the slides. What I'd really then like to do perhaps is just speak to you. I think with Zoom, you know, this whole format of you know, it's kind of terribly boring to just be looking at a slide with text while I'm speaking. So I will share slides. So my talk today, to give you, everyone can kind of see the screen. Yes? Okay, great. Let me just... So my talk today deals with, you know, the reason why I want to talk to you guys about the things that I'm going to talk about is because I'm working through these myself. And, you know, so partly these are observations. Some of them are rather provocative, so they can be read as provocations to the field of design and its various sort of disciplines. But it must be kept in mind that these are also sort of arguments that I'm also working around. And so what I'm hoping is that in our conversation, I'm hoping to go move through these things quickly so we can actually have a conversation, because that's the part that I'm really looking forward to. So I had four observations, and actually there's a fifth, but that comes towards the very end. And these observations kind of stem from my work at the intersection of decolonial theory, decolonial and postcolonial theory, design studies, and design history. But more so when I began looking at different perspectives from both the humanities and the social sciences, and when I began conducting my field work in Karachi, informed by those perspectives. These were perspectives taken from parts of the humanities and social sciences that you don't actually hear a lot about within the field of design, right? These are perspectives taken from various sort of approaches from fields like anthropology, history, critical cultural studies, and philosophy. And so, you know, very quickly, I wanted to, and you guys can make a note, I would highly recommend, you know, whenever I give lectures, I tell people, like, have your notebooks ready and be ready to note things down. I very quickly wanted to go through the five observations that I had, and then I can turn the PowerPoint off and we can actually have a talk. So the first observation, and I'm going backwards, is that logics, all research, is built or founded upon certain logics, right? Onto epistemological logics, right? I mean, it's there in the word, ontology, epistemology, right? The logos at the very end of the word, right? So all research and all knowledge production is driven by specific kinds of logics. And these logics reproduce themselves via knowledge production, via the act of doing research, via the acts of producing knowledge and putting it out there and disseminating it and having people sort of listen to what you have to say and sort of, you know, have it be a part of discourse. And that these specific logics and these specific knowledges that we are in the work of producing as scholars, as PhDs, as academics, they do specific things in the world. So knowledge has this transformative capacity, right? Just as design has a transformative capacity on the world. So that was my first, or observation number four, since we are going back in reverse. The second point that I have to make has to do with ontological insufficiency. So if we concede that all knowing is grounded within a certain kind of frame or a certain kind of logic, right? And I'll talk about that in a little bit. Then we have to admit that what we can know about the world, about communities, about people, about subjects, about phenomena that we are investigating will always be ontologically incomplete and insufficient. And the word that I use for this is I say, the logics that we often employ as scholars to make sense of phenomena or subjects within the world are ontologically insufficient. And this becomes particularly explicit when you find that the logic that you are employing is incommensurable with the phenomena or the subject that you are studying. What does that mean? Incommensurability in research? We'll talk about that in a little bit. But one thing that we must acknowledge as scholars and as researchers is that there are limits to our capacity to think through and to know and explain phenomena. The observation number two is that research is always a gestalt process. And when I use the word gestalt, obviously I'm talking about a relation between foreground and background, maybe middle grounds as well, right? And one must begin to think of research as this thing that brings certain things into the foreground and relegates other things within the phenomena that is being studied to the background, right? And in fact, does not merely relegate to the background, but may even render invisible things. And this is particularly decolonial scholars have a lot to say about this, right? The rendering invisible of populations, of communities, of knowledges, otherwise, right? So knowledge, the act of producing knowledge also is not just a constructive or a productive act. It is also a destructive act. It renders invisible and it even destroys. So it destroys other knowledges. Or one another way to put it, connecting back to point number four, is that certain logics destroy other logics or render invisible other logics. And then the first point that I come to is therefore, and this is something that I the word interlocutor that I'm using, I'm picking up from Gayatri Spivak's sort of like sense of it, from the discipline of subaltern studies, the Indian SSG. All researchers are unreliable interlocutors. If you begin to think of yourself not as a researcher, but as a subject embedded within certain logics, within certain cosmologies, having a particular onto-epistemic frame, and you add to that the relation that you have to the phenomena that you are studying or the subjects or the community that you are studying, and what you very quickly realize, this is related again to the earlier points, right, about ontological insufficiency and so on and so forth, that you are an unreliable interlocutor and an even more unreliable narrator, and that disturbs things, right? What place do you have to speak for and of the community or the phenomena or the subject in question that you are studying? And the last, I had said there were four, but the fifth is meant more as a direct provocation. The first four were more observations. An ethics or a politics of research should also consider the possibility of refusing the outcomes of research, or circumscribing them very strictly so that we can curtail the destruction that happens when knowledge is produced. And that's something to perhaps sort of sit with, and perhaps we can have a discussion around it. So with that, because I'd rather be able to see you people than have everyone staring at a screen full of boring text, I'm just gonna stop the share. Hopefully you guys would have taken, noted down the text. And I can send you guys the PowerPoint presentation. So let's start. So what do I mean by all of these things? I've used a lot of these words, right? I've used these words. I've used the word logic. I throw around the word ontological insufficiency. I throw around the word incommensurability. What do I mean by these things? My thinking One of the things that really sort of shaped my thought, and I think completely changed the direction, and both the direction and the approach that I was taking towards field work when I was doing it over the course of my PhD. And I'm assuming that most of you, if not all of you, would be engaged in some form of research. Some of you may be involved in field research, qualitative research, ethnography, and so on and so forth. But my thinking was greatly changed when I began to become much more acquainted with the literature that was emerging and that had been written, in some disciplines, for a very long time. In some, it was just beginning to kind of show. But there was literature that was emerging within particularly anthropology, and there were arguments being made by postcolonial and decolonial scholars that culture, what we deem to be culture, was actually not as a shallow, what we would call a shallow term, right? That the difference, if we think of culture as difference here in that sense must mean something deeper than just, oh, they have different values and norms and different rituals, and this other culture does things differently, right? So there's this particular argument, and you can find it in the ontological turn in anthropology, in the work of scholars like Vivieros de Castro and Martin Holbrod. You can find it in the earlier work. I mean, this has been a long-running thread in cultural anthropology, right? Which is a discipline that deals with the question of cultural difference, how deep or how shallow culture is, right? You can find it in earlier work too. I was particularly drawn to the work of Marilyn Strathern, for instance, and her sort of working through the concept of the relation, right? And you also find it in decolonial scholarship. You find it in the work of people like, not as perhaps as explicitly engaged with as an academic question, but you do find it in the work of people like Lorian Zaldúa, for instance, right? This question of difference, this question of other thought, this question of, and now it has become much more explicit perhaps in the decolonial turn, this question that differences between cultures are deep ontological differences. And what we mean by deep ontological differences, it means that different cultures throughout history have developed different relations, ways and means of relating to reality. Their relation to reality is different. Their perception of reality is different. What they feel they can do in reality is different. So the way that I translated this was that I began to pay attention to the ways in which different ontologies manifest and materialize themselves through social practices, as well as through made artifacts, through art objects of design and art, material culture, and so on and so forth, right? Building and so on and so forth. If one admits that cultural difference, or the term that I actually prefer to use instead of culture is cosmology, right? Cosmological difference also entails ontological difference, also entails a different kind of different epistemologies at play than the ones that we are used to. This really renders problematic the project of doing research, right? Because it does a number of things. So for example, one of the things that it shows us is that the frame or the perspective that I approach something with is necessarily always limited, particularly when I am studying phenomena that do not belong to a history, an experience, and a context that I am not privy to. And this has been a long-standing claim from critical cultural studies and critical theory within that domain, right? It is Edward Said talking about Orientalism, or whether it is, Ramon Gros Fauguel or Walter Mignolo talking about the coloniality of power and epistemic colonization. What they are really talking about is that you have Europeans, right, or people, and I would not even say Europeans, you have people who are employing an Anglo-Eurocentric logos, who are approaching a phenomena with cosmologies, ontologies, and frames that were developed within, that are Anglo-Eurocentric, right? Coming and trying to describe and explain phenomena which are not Anglo-Eurocentric. This has been the central argument of post-colonial and decolonial studies since their inception as formal disciplines, right? And so this poses a problem, right? Many of the earlier arguments didn't go as far as ontologies. They kind of slightly stayed at the surface. But now you're actually beginning to, you know, with the ontological turn and with decolonial scholarship in particular, there's the argument that what has been displaced are ontologies. So I tend to use the word logics whenever we are, and the word logic comes from this thing where I felt like the word ontology, like ontologies in themselves aren't completely up to the explanation, right? Ontologies are what? They are concepts. And yes, they do things out there in the world, right? In the sense that when we employ them to explain something, they reframe that and render what is incommensurable commensurable, so that it can be understood by other researchers, by other scholars, by other people working from within the same logos, right? So I began to use the word logic and logos more so because ontologies in themselves do a lot, but the other part that was missing was this idea of the relation, right? I'd spoken about Marilyn Strathairn had a huge sort of effect on my thinking through, you know, it is only when concepts and ontologies are put into relations that they actually begin to become active. And again, we can have a discussion around this. Like I said, these are all arguments that I'm working through and I'm writing about them and slowly beginning to publish them, although not as fast as I could. So I'll give you an example, you know, for those to just make it clearer. And I'll give an example that I often employ, and we'll be reading about this in my Saturday class, I think 2 weeks from now, when we talk about gender, decolonizing gender. So one of the, so Oyorinke Oyewemi, who is a Nigerian feminist philosopher, a decolonial feminist philosopher, she wrote this brilliant book called The Invention of Women, and it was based on the work that she did for her PhD dissertation. And I think there's a very useful, the reason why I'm bringing her up as an example is also, and there's a brilliant podcast that I can share with you where she actually narrates the whole experience of her doing a PhD and of how doing a PhD, she had to challenge her professors and teachers who, you know, her research was yielding things because she was starting from a place where she admitted ontological insufficiency, she was able to come to conclusions and thereby, you know, sort of come to these insights about gender in Nigeria in both the pre-colonial but also the contemporary era that you know, kind of upended the popular sort of conceptions about it in the field of sociology. So Oyorinke Oyewemi was a PhD student in sociology. She was studying at Berkeley. Yeah, I believe it was Berkeley, UC Berkeley. And she was doing her PhD. She was very interested in studying. So her dissertation was focused on studying motherhood, the phenomena of motherhood in Nigeria, right? And so she did her field work. She was doing her field work in Nigeria. One thing that she became very aware of, and this is precisely the kind of dual or the binary sort of mentality or the binary view that decolonial scholars talk about, right? That people today, migrants, immigrants, the what you would call thinking from the borders, the capacity, people who know that there are other and who can operate within other cosmologies and other cultures and other ontologies in the world, kind of have this, or would have this sort of binary view, right? So she you know, one thing that always disturbed her was that in Nigeria, and, you know, she's done a lot of empirical research to support this. She said that prior to colonization, the concept of gender did not exist as one of the central ontologies structuring society. So that's not saying that the concept of gender didn't exist in Nigeria. The concept of gender existed, but it existed very differently to the way that it did in Europe and North America and America, right? So part of her book makes this argument that there is a deep ontological difference and that there were incommensurabilities between these concepts of gender and its related concepts, right? Sex, sexuality, biology, and so on and so forth. All concepts are part of a constellation and they relate to other concepts. They never exist standalone, right? And she, you know, she makes several interesting, very interesting observations. She says that, you know, in the West, for instance, in Anglo-European sort of understandings of the body, you know, gender is based on biological, you know, its foundations as a concept lie in its ties to biology, and more particularly within the kind of Judeo-Christian and Anglo-Eurocentric tradition, they are very deeply tied to sexual difference or primary and secondary sexual characteristics. And she said that in Nigeria, this particular understanding of gender as based on ultimately a kind of biological sexual differentiation. And you must note that even in the West, the concept of gender has changed in the last 20 years. So she wrote The Invention of Women around like 20 to 25 years ago, right? But there have been social changes, you know, that have happened in America and Europe since then as well. But at the time, what she was writing was groundbreaking. It was completely revolutionary, right? She said that gender was based on other things. For example, one of the things that gender, and men and women, like females and males, I shouldn't use men and women, females and males could identify as man or woman depending on the kinds of social roles that they took up. So it was actually the other way around. It was social roles that determine gender, not gender that determines social roles, which I think is a really interesting argument. So what you begin to glean here through Oyewemi's sort of like work, right? And this is just one of many dozens, hundreds of examples, right? And I can give a few more, right? Is that there is a completely different logic that employs completely different understandings of ontologies at work in the world. And of course, one of her big arguments was that Western scholars in studying Nigeria tried to render commensurable that which was incommensurable. So they tried to translate gender into their own language and frame and try and explain Nigerian social phenomena through ontologies that were native to them. Another example that I can give, and this relates to my own sort of work, you know, I'm guessing many of you might have read Clive Dilnot, the design studies scholar, his work, The Gift, right? His work on The Gift. It's one of his very popular essays. I believe it was published in Design Issues. If you haven't read it, it's worth a read, right? And one of the things, and this is kind of me speaking through my own PhD experience, right? That it was a great article, and I have a great deal of respect for Clive, brilliant scholar, by the way. You know, if you haven't read The Design and the Question of History, I think his part in that is absolutely brilliant. But The Gift, you know, I was very interested in doing research upon The Gift and related concepts like sacrifice and so on and so forth. Right. And one of the things that always bothered me as a researcher was, you know, I began to think of The Gift in terms of, okay, you know, Clive's talking about The Gift, but he uses, like, you know, the popular gift theorists like Marcel Mauss, who's the anthropologist who originally wrote about gift as reciprocal exchange, had a very kind of transactional view of the gift, right? Gifts basically, you know, incur debt because they incur a kind of obligation. So the gift receiver then has to give a gift at some point later on, right? That was at the heart of sort of Maus's sort of conception of the gift. And it always, that never quite sat with me, because I knew that back home in Karachi, in Pakistan, and in, I believe the same would apply, or similarly would apply to India, the Indian subcontinent as a whole, perhaps. This conception of the gift did not sit well. The gift was not supposed to be reciprocal, right? It is supposed to be the opposite, in fact. So then I began actually doing research. And this is the reason why I'm telling you this, is so that as PhD students, it's to give you an example, right? Instead of trying to render commensurable, oh no, you know, people back home must be wrong, Maus must be right, Clive Dilnot must be right. So I need to now make sense of, and maybe create new concepts by which to make sense of these things. You know, the path that I took was I began to go backwards in time. So I began to study the gift historically in the Indian subcontinent. I began to study philosophically conceptions of the gift. And I began to look at and pay, give proper props to the phenomena in question. Not questioning when I was, so the word, you know, the two kinds of gifts, and there are many kinds of gifts. First of all, there is no universal gift in, at least in the Indian subcontinent. There are many different kinds of gifts. Some of them are actually reciprocal. Many of them are actually not. And they differ from the Western, the Anglo-Eurocentric perception of the gift, right? And I was looking particularly at two kinds, dan and dakshin. And there are specific kinds of dan as well, and different kinds of dakshin as well. And what I found was this incredibly rich, historically, contextualized, very rich description of gifts. And once you begin to understand those, you begin to understand why certain things in sort of like subcontinental society are structured the way they are, right? That's just another example, right? Now, why has no one, which then leads you to a question, right? Why are our popular, so one of Clive's sort of like, and other people have built on both his conception of gift as well as worked on Maus's, like my advisor, old advisor, Cameron Tonkinwise, has also written about gifts, right? And they always talk about gifts in relation to gift economies and sharing economies and forms of exchange that designers are working with. Then there's this question that you have, which is, why is all the work in design on gift economies and sharing economies from this Anglo-Eurocentric perspective with these ontologies, right? Why are these people talking about their ontologies as being universal, which is the central premise? Like, this is the challenge that post-colonial and decolonial scholarship had, to pose, right? Why do they not admit ontological insufficiency in their explanations, right? Why can't they just say, I am looking at this from a very particular history, experience, perspective, right? And that the kind of logic that I am employing to make sense of this phenomena is a limited, specific, historical logic, right? Historically continuous logic. Also, I have to be cognizant of time, so I'm going to try and hurry up because I do want to open this up for discussion, right? So that's precisely, I think that's why we kind of need to admit this kind of ontological, but there are ways around, particularly for researchers who are doing work in contexts with which they are and with communities with which they have nothing in common, right? Where there are incommensurabilities, right? There's been other work, lots of other work that I can name, like for example, Saba Mahmood's The Politics of Piety looks at the experiences of Muslim women, right? And shows us and tries to navigate and actually give credibility and credence to their experiences, which is what ontological insufficiency is about. It's actually giving, in a weird way, indirectly giving more voice to and more credence to the community and the subjects and the phenomena that you are studying than you would otherwise. Now,
as I say this, right? So the two points that I had to say, all research happens within a certain logic. And part of what design, I think design researchers need to be better at is questioning the kind of logics that they are working through, which means questioning the education that you've had, you've received, and B, admitting ontological insufficiency when you are actually doing research and giving credibility to the people, to the experiences and the ways in which people describe their life world. Because it has to be indicative if you, you know, because then you believe that what they're saying is indicative of, it's not just shallow, it's deep. It's indicative of a different relation to reality itself, to the body, to the environment, to the world, to other people, and so on and so forth, right? Socialization and so on and so forth. So now I come to my other, the last two points, the other two points that I had, which was, you know, this means that at the state we are, this means that we must rethink of what it means to do research and produce knowledge, right? Research does things in the world because it frames and reframes, it renders more commensurable or less commensurable. Right? It preserves incommensurability to a greater or lesser extent. And this also relates to another thing, right? Which decolonial and postcolonial scholars have talked about for a very long time, which is the capacity of produced knowledge to render invisible the voices of others and the experiences of others, right? And there, I mean, this particular terrain is much more, you know, complex and tenuous than it seems to be at first glance. But one thing, you know, that I would say before we move on to the subject of the interlocutor, the researcher as interlocutor, is that, is that essentially all knowledge render, you are always foregrounding something, and you are foregrounding something not only in the content of what you choose to focus on, in this phenomena or in this group that I am studying, there are certain things, usually that is framed by your topic, right? You pick a topic as a PhD student, you say, I'll study gifts. And that's what you pay attention to. So you pay attention to the things and you foreground those things in your research, right, that relate to the particular thing that you are looking for, and you render invisible other things, right? There is always this aspect of foregrounding and backgrounding. But I'm talking about foregrounding and backgrounding in a different sense, which is the foregrounding and backgrounding of ontologies and logics, right? You foreground a certain frame or a certain set of ontologies, of definitions, and a certain set of relations that those definitions are in to the fore, and you render invisible or you hide certain aspects of the ways in which the people you are studying relate to reality. And you render invisible those. And in fact, I would extend that argument even further. I mean, you know, this is the argument of epistemic colonization, right? That in doing so, you reify and strengthen certain ontologies and certain logics, certain kinds of logos, and you destroy, so that the very people who, you know, this is the argument where, like, for example, Dipesh Chakraborty, the Indian historian, right, subaltern studies historian, talks about this in Provincializing Europe, the book Provincializing Europe, which is a great read, by the way, especially the first chapter. You must read it. He makes this argument that he says that even Indian historians began to use British ways of thinking about Indian history. So you find that historians begin to make sense of their own culture's histories in an Anglo-European fashion. And the best example I can give, and I just wrote a paper on this that was published sometime, who knows, is like this whole, like, if you look at, for example, British colonialism and history and epistemic colonization in the 19th century, actually in the early to mid 19th century, you can find this in the work of James Mill, who was one of the early British historians of India, right? One of the things that Mill does is that he actually reconstructs a history of India that then becomes the basis for history education in India for at large, right? And the way that he does this is he breaks the history of India into three phases, right? So he says there's the Hindu phase, quote unquote, right? That is the classical or the ancient era. There's the Muslim medieval phase, and he particularly frames Muslims as conquerors, right? As invaders and as colonizers in their own right, right? Which leads to a whole host of other problems. And then he says that, and the modern era starts with the British, who civilized India and brought it railroads and modern medicine and all of these things and modern administration. And when you actually study the work so what is he doing? He is producing knowledge. What is it, you know, and what does that knowledge do? It does things in the world. It changes the way Indian administration works. It changes Indians' own understandings of their history. That continues to persist to this day. So knowledge isn't something that is apolitical or neutral. It has real historical weight, right? And what is destroyed in that process? A lot of other forms of histories, a lot of other historical structures and narratives. Those are destroyed, or those are rendered invisible, right? So that was, you know, and this brings me to my last point, which is if you believe in all of these things, then a couple of things should now be, and I'm going to close my talk in another 4 minutes because we're almost heading to 45 minutes now. It does a number of things, right? Number one, it forces you to reflect back on yourself and what you know, and thinking on what you know changes what you produce as knowledge, right? So that's the first thing. It should cause you to reflect on how what you know changes what you study and what knowledge you produce. The second is, and this is one of the, I think I is not one of the things that I mentioned outright, but I've mentioned in other places, historical and philosophical understandings are, this is why design studies is needed in design, right? And design history is needed in design, which unfortunately they are not taught so much in schools, right? And history and philosophy more generally, but one needs to sort of get to, there needs to be two moves. First of all, I think that the study of history and the historical contextualization of phenomena is absolutely essential to research. Not saying that you should become historians, but you should do the homework, right? The historical homework. Similarly, you should do the philosophical, the sort of like getting to the roots of the ontology, like questioning the logos and the ontologies and relations at play. That is a philosophical move. Philosophers do this, right? They go straight for the heart. They go straight for to the root of what it is that they are studying, right? So this kind of ontological questioning is I think fundamental to designers. Designers should learn how to do this. Not saying that you should become philosophers, but I think there needs to be a capacity in for designers to be able to do this. And indirectly, actually, designers are always doing this. They're doing this not in a negative sense, but in a positive sense, right? Whenever you say, oh, I need to create a design intervention, I need to rethink and come up with something new in the world, what you're actually doing, and I'm working off of Tony Fry's ontological designing, right? Design designs. You're designing, as designers, new ontologies. You are designing new social relations. You are not just designing artifacts, but those artifacts are the means by which you design new social relations and new social practices and new institutional structures and so on, and new programs and so on and so forth. You change the way that people behave, right? But you also are effectively either strengthening or weakening certain ontologies. Certain ways in which people think about themselves and each other and the world, right? And you are changing the nature of the relation, right? So designers are already always doing this when they are remaking the world via materials. But I think we need to be more conscious about, right? And then lastly, and this is just the last thing that I'll finish on, you know, it renders problematic. There are, of course, power relations between the researcher and the researched as well. And especially if we believe that knowledge renders invisible or destroys, I think this question of who as a researcher am I speaking for? Who will this knowledge benefit? Who will it not benefit or disempower? What is my relation to the group that I am studying? Have I built enough of a relationship to begin with? What gives me the credibility to speak? If I talk about myself, yes, I'm very interested in South Asia. That's where most of my work is based. But I'm also, male. I am what you would call, in caste terms, I would be upper caste. In Pakistan, at least, I would be that. In India, it would be completely different. I'm fairly well off. I'm middle class, which puts me at a very, in many ways, I actually don't share the worldviews and ways of relating to reality that many people back home share, right? So we must think of landscapes as heterogeneous, right? Just because you belong to or come from a certain place doesn't mean you're there is still layers and layers and layers of relations there that you need to navigate. And so the last point that I would give, and this is the provocation, right? And people like, Eve Tuck and Wayne Yang have talked about this, about research as refusal or refusing research, right? If we acknowledge that research and knowledge production does things out there, can we think about refusing the outcomes of our research from doing that work out there? Or can we circumscribe them more tightly? And I think admitting that work is locally specific and contingent is, I think, very important for that. But that's just the provocation that I would throw out. Perhaps we can use this in the discussion.